Chapter 8 Visions. The touch of earth seemed strange to me after nearly a week spent at sea, and as I sprang from the launch onto the rough rocks, I felt for a moment faint and giddy. The dark mountain summit seemed to swirl around me, and the glittering water had the uncanny effect of a great mirror in which appeared a fluttering vision of something undefined that rose and drifted off like a breath. I recovered myself with an effort and stood still, endeavoring to control the foolish throbbing of my heart. My companion, meanwhile, gave a few orders to his men in a language which I thought I knew, but could not follow. "Are you speaking Gaelic?" I asked him with a smile.
"No, only something very like it, Phoenician."
He looked straight at me as he said this, and his eyes, darkly blue and brilliant, expressed a world of meaning. All this country was familiar ground to the Phoenician colonists ages ago. I am sure you know that. The Gaelic tongue is a dialect of the ancient Phoenician Celtic, and when I speak the original language to a Highlander who knows only his native tongue, he understands me almost perfectly. I was silent. We stepped away from the shore and walked slowly side by side. Presently I paused, looking back at the launch we had just left. "Your men are not Highlanders?"
"No, they are from Egypt."
"But surely," I said with some hesitation, "Phoenician is no longer known or spoken in Egypt."
"Not in the world of ordinary men," he replied. "I know it and speak it, and so do most of those who serve me. You have heard it before, only you do not now remember."
I looked at him, startled, and he added, smiling,
"Nothing dies, not even a language."
We were not yet out of sight of the men, who had pushed the launch offshore again and were starting it back to the yacht, it having been arranged that they should return for us in a couple of hours. We were following a path near a rushing torrent, and on our way there were slippery stones that forced us to walk carefully. Then, as we rounded a sharp bend, we lost the view of Loch Scavaig itself and found ourselves, for the first time, truly alone. Huge mountains, crowned with jagged peaks, rose around us on all sides. On steep slopes, tufts of heather clung to large masses of dark stone that blazed rose purple in the declining sunlight. The hollow sound of the stream as it fell down became the bellow of occasional little waterfalls. These created a perpetual music in our ears, and the warm, stirless air appeared as though hung in suspense around us, waiting for the echo of some word or whisper that might betray some precious secret of the ages. Silence held us almost unbearably, till every nerve in my body felt like a harp string ready to snap at a touch. Yet I could not speak. I tried to master the rising tide of thoughts, memories, and emotions that surged upward within me like a tempest. Swiftly, peremptorily, I argued with myself that this extraordinary chaos in my mind was due only to my own imagination. Nevertheless, despite my efforts, I remained caught in a sort of web that imprisoned my every faculty and sense, a web fine as gossamer, yet unbreakable as iron. In a kind of desperation, I raised my eyes, which were burning with the heat of restrained tears, and I saw Santoris watching me with almost appealing tenderness. I felt that he could read my unexpressed difficulties and involuntarily stretched my hands out to him. "Tell me," I half whispered, "what is it I must know? We are strangers, and yet..." He caught my hands in his.
"Not strangers," he answered, his voice trembling a little. "You cannot say that. Not unknown to each other, but dear to one another of old. The gentleness of his strong grasp recalled to my mind the warm pressure of those invisible hands that, in my dream a few nights past, had guided me out of darkness. I looked up into his face, and every line of it seemed all at once familiar. The deep-set blue eyes, the broad brows and intellectual features, all these were as well known to me as might be the portrait of someone long beloved, and my heart almost stood still with the wonder of that recognition. "Not strangers," he repeated with quiet emphasis, as though to reassure me. "It is only that, since we last met, we have traveled far asunder. Have a little patience. You will presently remember me as well as I remember you." With the rush of startled recollection, I found my voice. "I remember you now," I said in low, unsteady tones. "I have seen you often, often. But where? Tell me where. Oh, surely you know." He continued to hold my hands with a tenderness that was also force. He seemed, like myself, to find speech difficult. If two deeply attached friends, parted for many years, were to meet all unexpectedly in some solitary place where neither had thought to see a living soul, their emotion could hardly have been more intense than ours. And yet, there seemed to be an invisible barrier between us, a barrier erected by one or the other of us that held us apart. The swift and subtle attraction that drew us together was held in check strangely by ourselves. It was as if each of us was separately surrounded by a circle into which neither of us dared to penetrate. I looked at him in mingled fear and questioning, and his eyes appeared gravely thoughtful. "Yes, I know," he said at last, answering in a low voice my unspoken question. Then, gently releasing one hand, but still holding me by the other, he repeated, "Yes, I know. But we need not speak of that. As I have already said, you will remember everything by gradual degrees. We are never permitted to forget entirely. Still, it is quite natural that in this immediate hour we should find it strange, you, perhaps more than I, that there should be something impelling us to each other, something that will not be gainsaid, something that no powers on earth or in heaven could contravene, and which, by simple law, will take no denial." I trembled, not with fear this time, but with an exquisite delight that I dared not analyze. He pressed my hand more closely. "We had better walk on," he said, momentarily averting his gaze from mine. "If I say more just now, I may say too much, and you will be frightened, perhaps even offended. I have been guilty of so many mistakes in the past. I ask you please to help me avoid them in the future. Come." He now turned his eyes on mine with a smile. "Let us see the sunset." We moved on in utter silence, he still holding my hand and guiding me up the rough path. The noise of the rushing torrent sounded louder in my ears, sometimes with chattering insistence, as though it sought to match the surging of my own quick pulse as I tried to drown my own thoughts. On we went. The path seemed interminable, though in reality we walked a comparatively short distance. Such a weight of unuttered and unutterable thoughts pressed on my soul that every step seemed to me almost a mile. At last we paused and found ourselves in full view of Lac Koryusk and of the majestic sunset above. There rose on all sides around us bare, lofty mountains, broken and furrowed here and there by deep rifts and quarries, with their stony peaks looking supremely impressive in their desolation, and rising so abruptly that it seemed impossible for any sunbeam to intrude cockily into such a dense circle of gloom. Yet I beheld a shower of gold pouring down aslant one of the highest hills, and brightening little clumps of heather, touching lightly on pale green patches of moss and lichen, and giving a dazzling flash of silver to the white wings of a seagull that soared above us, uttering wild cries of joy. Pale blue mists hovered above the lake's surface, and fitful gusts of air rushed down over the rocky summits to play with the impalpable vapors below them, borne inland from the Atlantic, and tossed them to and fro into fantastic shapes. Some of these looked like flying horses with long streams of hair lagging behind them. Some of the vapors looked like armed Norsemen hurtling spears against one another, and some of them looked like veiled ghosts hurrying by as though driven back to their land of shades by fear of substances unknown to them. We stood silently, hand in hand, watching the restless flitting of these cloud phantoms, and waiting for the intensifying glow which, when it spread upwards with rays from the sinking sun, would transform the wild scene into one of overwhelming splendor. All of a sudden, Santoris spoke. "Now shall I tell you where we last met?" He spoke very gently. "And may I show you the reasons why we meet again?" I lifted my eyes to his. My heart was beating with almost suffocating rapidity, and the thoughts in my brain threatened to overwhelm my diminishing self-control, making of me nothing but a creature of tears and passion. As I moved my lips in an effort to speak, no sound issued from them. "Do not be afraid," he continued in the same quiet tone. "It is true that we must be careful now, as in the past we have been careless. But perfect understanding of each other rests with ourselves. May I go on?" I gave a mute sign of assent. There was a rough crag nearby. It was shaped roughly like a small throne. Here he invited me to take a seat, then sat beside me quietly. We gazed out over a view of the head of the lake and of the great mountain enclosing and dominating it. The mountain was now bathed in a glow of orange, rose, and purple, while a thin mist moved slowly across it like a ghostly stage curtain on the point of rising to display the first scene of a great drama. "Sometimes," Raphael then said, "even in the world of artificial convention, it happens that two souls are brought together who, to their own immediate awareness, are unknown to each other, and yet, with the lightest touch, the swiftest glance, a million vibrations are set quivering within them like harp strings struck by the hand of a master harpist, and responding each to each in perfect harmony. They know not how it happens, they only feel it. When that happens, then nothing, I repeat with emphasis, nothing can keep them apart. Soul rushes to soul, heart leaps to heart, and all formal ceremony, custom, and common usage crumble to dust before the power that overwhelms them. These sudden effects of subtle sympathy occur every day among perfectly ordinary surroundings and between the most unlikely persons. And society, as it is presently constituted, frowns and shakes its head, jeering at what it cannot understand, and calls such heartfelt bonding folly, remaining willfully blind to that assertion of eternal law. It is a law, moreover, that cannot be set aside or broken with impunity. Just as the one point of vibration sympathetically strikes the other in the system of wireless telegraphy, so despite millions and millions of intervening currents and lines of divergence, the immortal soul spark strikes its kindred fire across a wasteland of worlds until they meet in the compelling flash of God's message called love. He paused, then went on slowly. No force can turn one aside from the other. Nothing can intervene. This is neither romance nor human emotion. It is simply the law. He paused. Do you understand? I bent my head silently. It may be thousands of years before such a meeting is consummated in soul union, he continued. For thousands of years are but hours, minutes, seconds in eternity. Yet in those thousands of years, what lives must be lived, what lessons must be learned, what sins must be committed and expiated, what precious time lost and found, what happiness missed, what merely temporary pleasure wasted. His voice was thrilling to listen to. And again he took my hand and held it gently. You must believe in yourself alone, he told me. If any lurking thought pulls you away from me, don't let it upset you. It is quite natural that you should feel such resistance a little. You have studied long and deeply. You have worked hard at problems that puzzle the strongest brains. And you have succeeded in many things, because you have kept what most people lose who grapple with science, faith. You have always kept your heart uplifted as you studied, reaching upward toward things unseen and eternal. But yours, too, has been a lonely heart, as lonely as my own. A moment's silence followed, a silence almost dark, and also heavy, like a passing cloud. Instinctively, I looked up to see if indeed a storm was gathering above us. But a heaven of splendid bright colors met my gaze. The whole sky shone with a glory almost heavenly. I watched this spectacle in an absorbed fascination, conscious all the while of the warm hand that held mine. It had strengthened its grasp. Suddenly, something sharp and brilliant, like forked lightning, flashed before me. The effect was slightly dizzying. The dark lake, the mountains, the entire landscape vanished like a mirage, and in the visible air, only a heavy curtain of mist remained. I made an effort to move, to speak, but in vain. I wondered, had some illness suddenly seized me? No, for the half-swooning feeling that had unsteadied me for a moment was now gone, and I was calm again. Yet I saw clearly before me a slowly moving panorama of scenes that presented themselves in marvelous outline and color. Episodes gradually unrolled before me and spread out against the gray background of an impalpable mist. I realized to the full that an eternal record is kept of every life, a record written not only in sound, but in light, in color, in melody, in exact proportion and harmony, and that not a word, not a thought, not an action is ever lost and forgotten. A vast forest rose before me. I saw the long shadows of leafy boughs lying upon the dark green sward, and wild tropical vines hanging rope-like from intertwined stems. A silvery moon gazed warmly through the branches of giant trees, flooding the darkness in the scene with a rippling radiance. Within this light, two human beings walked, a man and woman, their arms around each other, their faces leaning close together. The man seemed pleading with his companion for something which she withheld, and presently she drew herself away from him altogether in haughty rejection. I could not see her face, but her attire was regal, and on her head there shone a jeweled diadem. Her lover stood apart with bent head for a moment. Then he threw himself before her on his knees and caught her hand in an evident outburst of passionate entreaty. And as they stood together thus, I saw the phantom-like figure of another woman moving towards them. She came directly into the foreground of the picture, her white garments clinging about her, her fair hair flung loosely over her shoulders, and her whole demeanor expressive of both eagerness and fear. As she approached, the man saw her and sprang up from his knees in anger. Then, with a gesture of fury, he drew a dagger from his belt and plunged it into her heart. I beheld her reel back from the blow. I beheld the red blood well up through the whiteness of her clothing. And as she turned towards her murderer with a last look of appeal, I recognized my own face in hers, and in his face, the face of Santoris. I thought I uttered a cry, and then a darkness swept over me, and the vision vanished. A bodiless voice now spoke from everywhere and from nowhere. Passion stands with the flaming sword, barring any entrance to heaven. Beware of selfish love. Such love is not true love. It is possessive greed. Love is delicate, not coarse. Love is giving, not snatching from life the fruits it would bestow. Self-love is the source of all suffering. Another vivid flash struck my eyes, and I found myself looking upon the crowded thoroughfares of a great city. Towers and temples, palaces and broad highways presented themselves to my gaze in a network of great width and splendor. They moved and swayed before me in waves of glittering grandeur. Presently, this unsteady movement became resolved into form and order, and I became only one spectator among thousands in this scene of picturesque magnificence. It seemed that I stood in the enormous audience hall of a great palace. Here, countless slaves and other attendants, armed men, and hierarchies of leaders pursued their daily functions. Before the edifice there rose great pillars of stone on which were carved winged-headed monsters and menacing gods. I saw four giant sphinxes, somewhat shadowed, guarding a throne set high above the ground. A lambent light played quiveringly on the gorgeous scene, growing more and more vivid as I gazed, and throbbing with colorful motion. On the throne sat a proud-looking woman, crowned and veiled. In her right hand, she held a scepter that blazed with gems set in gold. Slaves clad in costumes of rich design and workmanship abased themselves on either side of her. I heard the clash of brazen cymbals and warlike music as crowds of people surged and swayed about her, murmuring and shouting, all evidently moved by some special excitement or interest. Suddenly I perceive the object on which the general attention was fixed, the prostrate body of a man, heavily bound in chains, lying at the foot of the throne. Beside him stood a tall black slave, masked and clad in vivid scarlet. This being of sinister aspect held uplifted a gleaming dagger ready to strike. As I beheld this impending tragedy, a wild yearning arose in me to save the threatened life of that bound and helpless victim. If only, I thought, I could rush to his defense and drag him away. But no, I was forced to stand by helplessly and watch the scene, every fiber of my brain burning with pity and compassion. At this moment, the crowned, veiled woman on the throne rose and stood upright. With a commanding gesture, she stretched out her glittering scepter. She gave the command. Swiftly the dagger gleamed through the air and struck its deadly blow through the man's heart. I turned my eyes away in shuddering despair, but I was compelled by some hidden power to raise them again. The scene before me glowed red, as with the hue of blood. I saw the slain victim, the tumultuous crowd, and above all, the relentless queen who, with a single movement of her little hand, had swept away a human life. As I gazed upon her with loathing, she threw back her golden veil. It was my own face that looked me full in the face. "Ah, wicked soul," I cried. "Oh, pitiless queen!" And then, as they lifted the body of the slain man, his pale countenance became turned toward me, and I saw again the face of Santorus. Dumb and despairing, I sank within myself, chilled almost to death with misery. And then for the second time, in this singular pageant, I heard a voice, slow, calm, and throbbing with infinite sadness in tone. "A life for a life, the eternal law, a life for a life. There is nothing taken which shall not be returned again, nothing lost which shall not be found, a life for a life. As thou hast received, so shalt thou give. But beware, give kindness where thou hast received hatred, give forgiveness where thou hast been wronged. Otherwise, the ripples of change will pass back and forth repeatedly between the shores of life, and thou shalt never find contentment." There followed silence and utter darkness. Slowly brightening, slowly widening, a pale radiance, like the earliest glimmer of dawn, stole gently upon my eyes when I raised them again. I saw the waving curve of a wide, slowly flowing river. Near it stood a temple of red granite, surrounded by shadowy foliage and bright clumps of gay flowers. Huge palm trees raised their fronded heads to the sky. On the edge of the quiet stream, I saw loitering a group of girls and women. One of these stood apart, sad and alone. The others looked at her with a mixture of pity and scorn. Near her stood a tall, upright column of black stone, bearing the sculptured head of a god. The features were calm, strong, and reposeful, expressive of dignity, wisdom, and power. As I looked, a crowd of people gathered together, and I heard strains of solemn music proceeding from the temple close by. Then the solitary woman drew herself farther apart and almost disappeared among the shadows. The light in the east grew brighter. Then the sun's rays shot upward. At this point, the door of the temple was suddenly thrown open, and a long procession of priests, each bearing a flaming taper and attended by boys dressed in white garments and garlanded with flowers, went in stately procession toward the column with the godlike head upon it. The priests slowly circled around it, chanting as they went, while the flower-garlanded boys swung golden censers to and fro, filling the air with the rich perfume of ceremonial incense. The great congregation of people knelt. Meanwhile, the priests continued to pace round and round, chanting solemn prayers until at last the great sun raised the edge of its glowing disk above the horizon, and its rays sprang from the east like golden arrows. They struck the brow of the great head on its black pedestal. With the sudden glitter of this glory of the dawn, all chanting ceased. The procession stopped, and one priest, tall and commanding of aspect, stepped forth from the rest. He held his hands high to enjoin silence, and then the head quivered as with life. Its lips moved. There was a rippling sound like the chord of a harp stroked by the wind. Then a voice, full, sweet, and resonant, spoke aloud the words, "Face the sunrise." With a joyful shout, both priests and congregation responded, "We face the sunrise." And he, who seemed the highest in authority, raising his arms invokingly toward heaven, exclaimed, "Even so, O mightiest of the mighty, let us always remember that thy darkest shadow belongs to thy light, that sorrow is only the retreating wave of joy, that death is only the darkness after the same day of life. We face the sunrise." At that point, all who were there assembled joined in singing a strange paean of joy, to the strains of which they slowly moved off and disappeared like breath on a mirror, quickly fading away. Only the tall high priest remained. He alone waited, it seemed, for something eagerly expected and desired. And presently, the woman who till now had remained hidden in the shadows of the surrounding trees came swiftly forward. She was very pale. Her eyes shone with tears. And again, I saw my own face in hers. The priest went quickly to greet her, and I distinctly heard every word he spoke as he caught her hands in his own and drew her towards him. "Everything in this world and the next," he said, "I will resign for love of thee. Honor, dignity, and this poor earth's renown, I lay at thy feet, thou most beloved of human beings. What other thing created or imagined can be compared to the joy of thee, to the sweetness of thy lips, to the softness of thy bosom? How moved I am by the love that trembles into confession with thy smile. Oh, imprison me but in thine arms, and I shall count my very soul well lost for an hour of thy love. Ah, deny me not. Turn me not away again. Love such as this comes but once in a lifetime. Love such as ours, early or late, it comes but once." She looked at him with tender passion and pity, a look in which I thankfully saw no trace of pride, resentment, or affected injury. "Oh, my beloved," she answered. Her voice, sweet and plaintive, thrilled the silence like a pearly drop of pain. "Why wilt thou rush upon destruction for so poor a thing as I? Knowest thou not, and wilt thou not remember, that to a priest of thy great order the love of woman is forbidden, and that the punishment thereof is death? Already the people view thee with suspicion, and me with scorn. Forbear, O dearest, bravest soul, be strong in thyself. Strong? He echoed. Is it not strong to love? Aye, it is the very best of strength. For what avails the power of man, if he may not gain the loving consent of a woman? Child, where love is, there can be no death. There can be only life. Love is the ever-flowing current of eternity in my veins. It is the pulse of everlasting youth and victory. What are the foolish creeds of man compared to this one truth of nature, love? Is not the deity himself our supreme lover? And wouldst thou leave me a castaway from his holiest law? Ah, no, come to me, my beloved, soul of my soul, inmost core of my very heart. Come to me in secrecy, when no one sees and no one hears. Come when... He broke off, checked by her sudden look of smiling rapture. Some thought evidently had cleared her doubts away like a ray of light. So be it, she said. I give thee my entire self from this time forth. Yes, I will come. He uttered an exclamation of joy and drew her so close that her head rested on his breast, and her loosened hair fell in a cascade of silken black across his arms. At last, he murmured, at last, mine, all mine, this tender soul, this loving heart, mine, this exquisite life forevermore. O crown of my life, when wilt thou come to me? She answered at once, without hesitation. Tonight, she said, tonight, when the moon rises, let us meet here in this very place, this sacred grove, where Memnon hears thy vows to him cast aside, and my vows forever consecrated to thee. As I live, I swear I will be thine alone. But leave me now here to pray. She lifted her head and looked into his adoring eyes, then kissed him with a strange, grave tenderness, almost as though bidding him farewell. With a gentle pressure then, she motioned him away. He, elated and flushed with joy by her sign, left her and disappeared in the same phantom-like way in which all the other figures in this weird dream drama had made their exits and their entrances. She watched him go with a wistful, yearning gaze. Then, with a gesture of utter desperation, she threw herself on her knees before the impassive head, resting sternly on its rocky pedestal. She prayed aloud, O hidden and unknown God, whom we poor earthly creatures have symbolized in this carving, give me the strength to love unselfishly, the patience to endure uncomplainingly. Thou heart of stone, temper with thy cold wisdom my throbbing heart of flesh. Help me to still the tempest in my soul, and let me be, even as thou art, inflexible, immovable, save when the sun strikes music from thy dreaming brows and tells thee it is day. Forgive, O great God, forgive the fault of my beloved, a fault which is not his, but mine, merely because I live and he finds me fair. Let all be well with him. For me, however, let nothing hinder me from what I must do. Teach me, even me, to be strong and face the sunrise. Her voice ceased. A mist came before me for a moment, and when this cleared, the same scene was presented to me under the glimmer of a ghostly moon. And she, who looked so like myself, lay dead at the foot of the great statue, her hands clasped on her breast, her eyes closed, her mouth smiling as if in sleep. Beside her raved and wept her priestly lover, invoking her by every tender name he could think of, clasping her lifeless body in his arms, covering her face with useless, passionate kisses, and with wild grief, calling her back from the silence into which her soul had fled. And I knew then that she had put aside all thought of self in a sense of devotion to duty. She had chosen what she understood to be the only way out of her difficulty. In order to save the honor of her lover, she had slain herself. Had she been right or foolish? The question pressed itself insistently on my mind. She had given her life to serve a creed she believed in, but she had sacrificed herself for a greater love. Was hers a surrender to the conventions of a superficial man-made code? Was her love selfless and pure, or was it polluted with passion? Was not love the nearest thing to God? And if those two souls were destined lovers, could they be divided, even by their own rashness? These questions churned in my mind as I gazed upon the poor, fragile corpse lying there on the temple grounds. Of a sudden, I heard an unbodied voice call to me from everywhere and nowhere. That religion was not false, for it symbolized great truths. Idol worship is pure if it is directed Godward. Thou, alas, practiced real idol worship, thy lover even more so. Your love was for that which must perish, the bodily form. God has no form. Learn to love thy twin soul as soul for soul, not as body for body, nor even as mind for mind. The commandments of man, if rooted in love for the highest, may not lightly be ignored. Learn the secret of true union, if thou wouldst find the secret of lasting joy. I closed my eyes to contemplate these truths. Presently I became conscious of a deep, murmuring sound, like the subdued hum of many thousands of voices. And lifting my gaze, I saw the wide circular sweep of a vast arena crowded with people. In the center, and well to the front of the uplifted tiers of seats, there was a gorgeous pavilion of gold, draped with gaudy colored silk and hung with festoons of roses. Therein sat a heavily built, brutish-looking man, royally robed, crowned, and wearing jewels in such profusion as to seem literally clothed in flashing points of light. Beautiful women were gathered about him. Boys with musical instruments crouched at his feet. Attendants stood around to minister to his every call or desire, and all eyes were fixed upon him as upon some god to be worshipped. I felt and knew that I was looking upon the shadow presentment of the Roman tyrant Nero, and I wondered vaguely how it chanced that he, in all the splendor of his wild and terrible career, should have been brought into this phantasmagoria of a dream, in which I, and one other alone, seemed to be chiefly concerned. Strange noises were in my ears, the loud din of trumpets, the softer sound of harps playing in the distance, the ever-increasing buzz of voices in the multitude, and then, all at once, the roar of wild beasts. The time of this vision seemed to be late afternoon. I thought I saw a line of deep crimson in a sky where the sun had lately set. The flare of torches glimmered around the arena, and beyond it, reflecting brilliantly in the jewels on Nero's breast, and throwing into strong relief the groups of soldiers and people immediately around him. I perceive now that the center of the arena, previously empty, had become the spot singled out by the people. One woman was standing there all alone. She was clad in white, and her arms were crossed over her breast. So still was she, so apparently unconscious of her position, that the mob, irritated by her calmness, grew suddenly impatient. A fierce cry arose. "The lions! The lions!" The emperor stirred from his indolent, half-recumbent position, with a sudden look of interest on his lowering brows. As he did so, a man attired in the costume of a gladiator entered the arena from one of its side doors and, with calm step and assured demeanor, walked to the front of the royal dais and there dropped on one knee. Then rising quickly, he drew himself erect and turned toward the woman waiting. His eyes were fixed on her. She, meanwhile, stood immovable as a statue, apparently resigned to some undesired fate. Again that vast crowd shouted, "The lions! The lions!" There came a heavy grating sound of bolts being drawn, the sound of falling chains. Then came a savage animal roar, and two lean and ferocious lions sprang with lashing tails into the arena, their manes bristling, and in their eyes a look of hunger. Quick as thought, the gladiators stood in their path. I immediately recognized the nature of the sport that had enticed the emperor and all this noisy show of humanity out to watch what to them was merely a game. The life of a Christian being crushed by the fangs of wild beasts. It was a common pastime, unchecked by either human mercy or the intervention of God. And I understood clearly that the woman who stood so nobly awaiting her death had but one chance of rescue, the hope that the gladiator had been brought there to combat and save her from their intended victim, and reward for him being, should he succeed, the woman herself. I gazed with straining eyes on the terrible spectacle. My heart beat strongly as I saw one of the lions stealthily approach the lone martyr and prepare to spring. Like lightning, the gladiator was upon the famished brute, fighting it fiercely in horrible contest. Meanwhile, the second lion leapt forward, intent on a similar attack. It also was beaten back. The battle between man and beast was prolonged, furious, and terrible to witness. But the mob's excitement grew in intensity. "The lions! The lions!" was now the cry heard everywhere, rising with increasing volume to an almost frantic clamor. The woman, meanwhile, never stirred. Like a motionless statue, she appeared to notice neither the lions nor the gladiator who fought in her defense. As with keen interest I studied her impassive figure, I strained to see her face. I instinctively knew I should recognize it. Presently, as if in response to my thought, she turned toward me, and as though in a mirror, I saw my own reflected person again, as I had beheld repeatedly in this chain of strange episodes in which I had found myself so singularly involved, always as an outside spectator. Between her shadow figure and myself, there seemed to be a pale line of connecting light, and my whole being thrilled towards her with heartfelt anxiety. A swirling mist suddenly came before my eyes, and when it cleared, I saw that the combat was over. The lions lay prostrate, dead, and weltering in their own blood on the trampled sand of the arena. The victorious gladiators stood over their bodies triumphant, surrounded by the deafening cheers of the multitude. Wreaths of flowers were tossed to him from the people, who were standing in their seats around the great arena, to hail him with acclamation, and the emperor, lifting his unwieldy body, stretched out his hand as a sign that the prize earned so bravely was now his. The gladiator, his chest still heaving from the mighty struggle, crossed one arm over his chest in salutation. The woman, however, hitherto so passive and unmoving, stirred slightly, fixing a gaze of the deepest reproach on the gladiator. She raised a hand warningly, forbidding him to approach her. At that moment, she fell face downward to the ground. The man rushed to her side and, kneeling down, sought to raise her. After a moment, he suddenly sprang to his feet and, erect with a loud cry, shouted, "Great Emperor, I asked of thee a living love. This one is dead." A ripple of laughter ran through the crowd. The Emperor leaned forward and smiled. "Thank her Christian God for that," he shouted back. "Our pagan deities are more merciful. They give us love for love." The gladiator gave a wild gesture of despair and turned his face up to the light. It was the face of Santorus. "Dead, dead," he cried. "Of what use then is life? Dark are these beloved eyes, cold is this generous heart. My battle has been in vain. Victory mocks me with my triumph. The whole world for me is now empty." Again the laughter of the populace stirred the air.
"Go to, man."
The rough voice of Nero sounded harshly above the din.
"The world was never the worse for one woman the less. Wouldst thou also be a Christian? Take heed, our lions are still hungry. Thy love is dead, 'tis true, but it is not we who killed her. She trusted in her God, and he has betrayed her, robbing thee of thy lawful possession. Blame him, not us. Go hence. Thy laurels have been bravely won. Nero commends thee for thy prowess."
He flung a purse of gold at the gladiator's feet, and I saw the whole scene melt away into a confusion of light, till all became a pearl-gray haze floating before my eyes. The same voice as before then spoke to me yet again. "Luckless soul, thou didst seek at last the highest love in God. Human love, however, especially that which is shared with all, is a part of love for God. Thou didst repel thy lover. It would have been better hadst thou embraced that multitude with the open arms of forgiveness. For even in their zeal to see thy destruction, they were only his misguided children. To love him truly, thou must learn to love him even in those who persecute thee. Repel nothing. Embrace all in God." I was hardly allowed a moment's respite before another scene presented itself before me. Like a painting, upon the curtain of vapor which hung so persistently before me. This scene struck a closer chord upon my memory than any I had yet beheld. The cool, spacious interior of a marble-pillared hall or studio slowly disclosed itself to my view. It was open to an enchanting vista of terraced gardens and dark, undulating woods. Gay patterns of brilliant blossoms spread out before me like a wonderful carpet of intricate and exquisite design. Within the studio was the combination of grace and confusion normally seen in an artist's studio. At an easel working assiduously, was the artist himself. His face turned toward the canvas, away from me. Posed before him in an attitude of indolent grace, sat a beautiful woman, arrayed in clinging diaphanous drapery. A few jewels gleamed here and there on her garment, glistening like stars upon her arms and bosom. Her hair, falling in loose waves from a band of pale blue velvet that encircled her brow, was a warm brown in color, like a leaf in autumn with the sun shining on it. I could see that whatever she might be according to the strictest canons of beauty, the man who was painting her portrait considered her more than beautiful. I heard his voice, low and murmurous, yet as distinct in its diction as all the sounds had been conveyed to me in this dream pageant. It was exactly as if two persons on a stage had been speaking to the audience. "If we could understand each other," he said, "I think all would be well with us in time and eternity." There was a pause. The picturesque scene before me seemed to glow and gather in intensity as I gazed. "I know what is in your heart," she said. "It beats with mine. Yet, alas, I am the ward of a wealthy nobleman. His desire is to wed me. Were you and I to wed each other, he would kill us. He's not a good man. He's self-concerned, heartless, and..." She hesitated a moment, then continued, "evil." "I am aware of that," replied the artist. "When he commissioned me to paint your portrait, he knew I loved you. I think he hired me because he thought he could gloat over us both. Even now he comes into this studio to chuckle inwardly at our suffering." "Is it necessary that we be together?" she asked him, tears in her eyes. "Could we both enter monasteries? Our love, in any case, is given above all to God." He smiled suddenly. "That is the only solution," he cried. "But can I escape this spider's web?" she asked. "Let us wait until tonight. I can wait for you below the walls of this castle. He cannot prevent us from giving our lives to God." "Oh, therein lies the answer," she said in return, looking furtively toward the door. "We'll enter two monasteries. There, in lives of holy dedication, our prayers to God will bring us also soul union with each other." The artist rose and came away from his canvas. Approaching her, he took her hands in his, and with an ecstatic smile, gazed deeply into her eyes. "Cosimo de' Medici shall not spoil your kind nature with his dark self-serving." At this name there crept upon the scene a kind of unearthly shadow and a sense of cold. "Cosimo de' Medici," he repeated slowly. "My patron would scarcely thank me for what we have planned." "Cosimo de' Medici." The name issued from another quarter. A shadow fell across the scene, and a woman, dark and heavy-featured, stood like a blot in the sunlit brightness of the studio, a woman richly attired, who gazed fixedly at the lovers with heavy-lidded, suspicious eyes and a smile that was a sneer. As the artist turned and saw her, his face changed from joy to a look of pale anxiety. Yet even so, holding his love with one arm, he flung his uplifted head in fearless demeanor, bold defiance at this intruder. "Spy," he exclaimed, "do your worst. Let us have an end to your serpent vigilance and perfidy. Better death than the constant sight of you. What? Have you not watched us long enough to make discovery easy? Do your worst, I say. Do it quickly." The cruel smile deepened on the woman's mouth. She made no answer, but simply raised her hand. In immediate answer to the signal, a man, clad in the Florentine dress of the 16th century and wearing a singular collar of jewels, stepped out from behind a curtain, attended by two other men who seemed, by their dress, to be of inferior rank. Without a word, these three threw themselves upon the unarmed and defenseless artist with the fury of animals pouncing on their prey. There was a brief and breathless struggle. Three daggers gleamed in the air, a moan in the stillness, and in another instant the victim lay dead, stabbed in the heart. She who had just held his living hands and felt their warmth dropped on her knees beside the corpse with a loud wail of despair. "Another crime on your soul, another murder of a nobler life than yours. May heaven pay you for it. But you cannot part my love from me. No, you have but united us forever." And snatching a dagger from the hand of one of the assassins, before he could prevent her, she plunged it into her own breast. She fell, self-slain, without a groan. And I saw, as if in the mist of breath on a mirror, the sudden horror on the faces of the men and the one woman who were left to contemplate the ghastly deed they had committed. And then, noting as in some old, blurred picture the features of the man who wore the collar of jewels, I felt that I knew him, yet I could not place him in my mind. Gradually this strange scene of cool white marble, with its brilliant vista of flowers and foliage under the bright Italian sky, and the betrayed lovers lying dead beside each other in the presence of their murderers, passed away like a floating cloud. And the same slow, calm voice I had heard before now spoke again in stern but tender accents. "Desire is not love. Love is self-sacrifice. Love is martyrdom of self. It is self-giving, not receiving. Possessiveness is evil and brings great suffering on earth. Your desire to live for God was sanctified, even though it could never be fulfilled, and their vengefulness will receive its just rewards." I closed my eyes. A soothing calm came over me. When I opened my eyes again, I saw two figures on a ship at sea. They were standing together, gazing over the water toward the horizon. The man then spoke. "Dearest, we are all in all to each other. I know that. You know that. But the nature of this world is change. All things, in order for God to manifest them, must exist in a dual state. Our lot cannot be any different from that which attends all manifested life. Therefore, for you and me, true unity can occur only if we merge in God. Otherwise, even our felicity must someday change, if not to its opposite, then at least to something different. I say not to its opposite, for we have understood that our happiness in one another exists above all in our hearts. Otherwise, we would surely lose it again, for the only truth is the one undivided Spirit of God. Therefore, dear one, let our love be primarily love for one another in God." "Dearest," the woman answered, "I understand, and I accept what you say. We have lived apart in monasteries. Our love, even then, was not of body for body, but of soul for soul. Let our merging, then, be above all a merging in Him, and our love be primarily for our infinite source in Him. Thus only can our love keep on expanding to infinity and not be smothered in finitude." They gazed into each other's eyes with the fondness born in eternity. Suddenly, then, the breeze that tugged lightly on their garments began gaining in strength, dark clouds started to form above them, and what was now a wind grew to become a gale. Soon it was evident that a severe storm threatened. The sea grew wild, gloomy, gray, and grand in its on-sweeping wrath. Its huge billows rose and fell with mountainous force. Among the toppling crests of foam, I could hear the savage hiss and boom of breakers dashing themselves against some unseen rocky coast in the distance. My heart grew cold with dread as I beheld the ship struggling against the onslaught of wind and rain, like a feather dropped from a seagull's wing. Flying along like a hunted creature, the ship staggered and plunged, her bowsprit dipping into deep chasms from which she was tossed upward, shudderingly, again and again, as if in light contempt. "This is the end of our present life, dearest. Are you afraid?"
"Afraid?"
And her voice had no tremor. "Are we not both pledged to the one, the only truth?" A cry went up from the sailors, a cry of heart-rending agony, as an enormous billow hurled itself upon the frail craft, engulfing it. The vessel disappeared with terrible swiftness, as if sucked down by a whirlpool. The vast solemnity of the sea spread over the ship like a pall. What there had been of man was now nothing, and became nothingness. There came upon my soul a sense of deep calm. The great sea smoothed itself out before my eyes into fine ripples, which dispersed gradually into mist again, and I almost found my voice. My lips opened to ask, "What means this vision of the sea?" But just then, a sound of music checked me on the verge of utterance, the music of delicate strings on a thousand heavenly harps. I listened, entranced. My gaze was still focused on the heavy grayness before me, that mystic sky canvas upon which some divine painter had depicted scenes in lifelike form and color, which I, in a sort of dim strangeness, recognized yet could not understand. And as I looked upward, a rainbow with every hue intensified to such a blazing depth of brilliancy that its light dazzled my eyes almost beyond bearing, became a perfect arch across the cloud. I uttered an involuntary cry of rapture, for it was like no earthly rainbow I had ever seen. Its palpitating light seemed to penetrate to the very core and center of space, delicate yet deep. Each separate color glowed with the fervent splendor of a glory undreamed. It was the assurance of joy after sorrow, the passionate love of the soul, rising upwards in perfect form and beauty after long imprisonment in ice-bound depths of mortality. It was anything and everything that could be thought or imagined of divinest promise. And then came uncannily rapid, passing scenes as of cloud forms constantly shifting and changing, in all of which I discerned the same two personalities, so like and yet so unlike ourselves, who had been the dumb witnesses of every episode, but now everything passed into absolute silence. No music. All voices had ceased. Everything was mute. Suddenly there came a change over what I thought was the sky. Clouds were torn asunder to show a breadth of burning amber and rose, and I beheld rays of a light too subtle to be sunlight, shining outward from our own forms to infinity, and a voice called to us, "Walk these many paths from your own heart centers to infinity. Oh, walk the pathway to omnipresence, and become one with thee and with thy love. Lord, help them to become freed of all earth chains, for they are thy children. They long for thee. Long have they suffered in exile. Let them merge in perfect freedom in thee. Their kneeling figures, now plainly discernible, seemed gradually to melt into the light surrounding them, and the great voice spoke again. Love can be perfected only in perfection itself, and perfection is God. There must be no desires, no attachments, no self-limiting, ego-centered thoughts of any kind. Souls were created dual, and their merging is the extinction of their separate individuality, and a blending together in a perfection of love that for separate beings is not possible. It is the recognition that their love for each other comes from God and can find its fulfillment in Him alone. Something then, I know not what, brought me down from that pinnacle of vision. Hardly aware of what I was doing, I withdrew my hand from that of my companion. I then saw only the solemn physical grandeur of Loch Koryusk, with a deep amber glow touching the summit of the mountain from the setting sun. I gave an involuntary sigh. Then, at last, with a little dreading hesitation, I looked full at Santorus. His eyes met mine steadily. He was very pale. After we had faced each other in silence for a moment, he said quietly, "How quickly the time has passed. This is the best time for the sunset. When that glory fades, we shall have seen all."